Hello, busybodies. Welcome to another episode of The Busyness Paradox. I'm Frank Butler, here with Paul Harvey.
Good day.
And on today's episode, what are we talking about, Paul?
Cults.
Cults.
I want to talk about cults.
Oh, I like it.
Starting one, being in one, recruiting.
So you're trying to say we're going to try to create a cult of busybodies.
A cult of busybodies. You got it.
Man, I love it. Yep. I love it. Let's do it.
So listeners, cult up.
It's time to cult up.
Time to cult up. Apparently that involves the following. Submission, exclusivity, persecution complex. Got to have one of those. Control, of course. Isolation, love bombing. That's an interesting term. Showering with affection, gifts of affirmation, and so on. Threats of loss of love.
Ooh.
Special knowledge, indoctrination, salvation, groupthink, cognitive dissonance, all good stuff. Shunning, strict gender roles, appearance standards, lack of accountability. All this coming from Dr. Christina Villarreal, apparently a student of Margaret Singer, who did a lot of the foundational work on cults in the mid-90s and such. And how is this relevant to busyness, you might ask? Besides the fact that we're starting our own cult of busyness, the answer comes to us from arguably Silicon Valley. So this is a concern that's been raised several times in recent years, that some of these tech startups have developed a cultural playbook that's fairly similar from one company to the next and results in organizational cultures at these startups that in some cases is a little bit difficult to distinguish from that of a cult. So, Frank, you being more the macro strategy level person, I sprung this on you because I figure this is probably something that you know a little bit about, startup culture and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm interested to get your take on it.
Mm-hmm.
I've mentioned in past episodes the book Disrupted by Dan Lyons, real funny guy, and his take on working at a tech startup, a quote-unquote Silicon Valley startup, although it's actually in Cambridge.
Dan Lyons. He's been a writer for the actual show Silicon Valley.
That's right.
It's on Showtime, I think.
HBO,
yeah.
I believe, actually, he left his job at HubSpot to become a writer on Silicon Valley.
Man, that show was great. It would crack me up.
It's one of the funniest shows. If you've ever started any kind of a business, as we both have, you can tell that the writing comes from people who have lived the experience.
Yeah.
I can't say that I've had much experience with a tech startup. I can say that I've had none. But I know several people who have, and they say it's almost eerie how spot on that show is. But anyway, he gives a humorous, kind of lighthearted, but a little bit serious account of his time working at HubSpot, 30 years older than the average employee, and complete fish out of water story. Some of the humor points are right on the edge of, this is funny, but it's also a little possibly scary. I don't want to necessarily pick on HubSpot here, but a lot of these tech startups seem to have similar cultures that, like I said, follow the same playbook. And it doesn't always end well. I'm thinking of Theranos as an example.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Where you see a lot of these parallels of that list of things I just mentioned at the beginning here. The characteristics of cults.
Kind of what it takes to create a cult,
yes,
right?
Yes, the control, the persecution, exclusivity, submission.
Yeah, my favorite, though, is still appearance standards. And I'm like, I can live up to that.
I'm looking at us both on Zoom like, maybe we're not the ones.
I got my hoodie on right now, unzipped, t-shirt underneath.
You must look like us.
My hat on.
Find your worst clothes. Throw them out. Go find someone else's worst clothes. Put them on.
That's right. Scarily enough, Paul and I are both wearing hoodies. Mine's a zip up, though. Is your zip? Yep, his is zip up.
It's a zip up.
Well, darn.
And it lights up.
Oh, and his lights up.
Mine's a heated hoodie. Yeah.
I'm jealous of the heated hoodie, but.
Red, white, or blue. Red.
I mean.
Blue. So. I'm gonna leave it on to make you jealous.
Okay, that's the next level is that. Okay, we're going to upgrade our hoodies to hoodies that are battery powered for heat and have a light built into them that can be red, white, or blue. Is that what you're...
Yep. Hot, medium, high, low, medium colors, red, white, and blue.
Well, there you go. And then we'll all have baseball caps too. Yep. That's going to be our appearance standards.
Yep.
That's going to be the busyness body cult outfit of choice.
You're not welcome to listen to our show if you're not wearing. I can't even follow that.
I can't even do
don't
it.
Don't be like us. We don't dress well. Anyway, so this Dr. Christina Villarreal, sorry if I'm mispronouncing it, wrote this article called Can You Tell the Difference Between a Cult and Your Startup? Take the test. It's not really a test, but it goes through this bullet list of things associated with cult practices, brainwashing techniques and such, and draws kind of freaky parallels to what we see. And this is where I become interested. We don't really see this anywhere but these tech startups. It seems to be a cultural playbook that sort of apes the culture of the first dot-com boom in the late 90s, early 2000s, when you had college grads or college dropouts or whatever kind of running the show and running a company exactly how you think a college student would run a company, with the beer pong tables and beanbag chairs and whatever. What's interesting to me about this second coming of the tech wave is that we're seeing the same potentially cultish cultural elements, despite the fact that it's really venture capitalists behind the scenes controlling things to a much greater degree than it was in the first dot-com wave. So it's interesting to me that they're sort of replicating the culture of that first dot-com wave, even though it's coming from a different place. And we've never seen this approach to culture anywhere but quote-unquote Silicon Valley tech startups or established companies now, like Google, what have you. So that tells me that it can't be that successful of an approach, because no other companies have really tried it or succeeded with it. Only these tech companies. So why is that?
You know, thinking more generally about it, one of the first blog posts, or I think my first blog post for the Business Paradox, was about racism in software. Knowing the Valley and knowing these kinds of companies and such, I was able to think about those elements and go, you know, I would assume that they're male dominant, which yeah. I think is very true, especially in the IT software development, software engineering side of things. But at the same time, they're also clustered in a very similar area, right? And most of the people who are going to that region are feeding through the same schools, Caltech, Cal Berkeley.
For the ones that are in Silicon Valley.
Actually, interestingly enough, I know Georgia Tech supplies a lot. And back when I was in college at the University of Georgia as an undergrad, we used to make fun of the Georgia Tech students because they would have to come to Athens to meet women because at Georgia Tech. Now it's a joke. Please, you know.
Well, certainly there's self-selection, though. It's a field that tends to draw men, yeah.
Right. So you've got this self-selection kind of going on. But also, I think one of the other elements that we see in this process is this notion that Michael Porter, I think, talks about a lot with clusters for industry, too. He talks about these industry clusters. And this is a great example. Silicon Valley is the definition of a cluster for an industry, right? Most software development companies or software as a service or whatever it is have really flocked toward the Valley, right? To San Francisco and the Valley area. And it makes sense, right? If you go back into history, Hewlett Packard originated out of there. I believe Intel was out of there as well. I might be wrong about Intel, but I know
Hewlett Packard started.
You know, and I think there was some companies there that were also doing things with NASA, right?
Yeah.
So really trying to be at the forefront of tech. And then, of course, because of that exposure that people have in that area, they cue off of that. They get jobs and internships in these areas. They develop their expertise. And then they go off and start businesses because they see opportunities and so on and so forth. So it makes sense that there's this cluster there that's specific to that. But
I get that. But what about like HubSpot, to use Dan Lyon's example, it's over in Boston,
yeah.
And like the clusters that we're seeing in, I don't know, Vermont and Chicago area. Geographical clustering doesn't seem to explain why where the companies themselves, I shouldn't say that, where similar types of companies have sprouted up outside the actual physical valley.
Right.
They seem to follow the same cultural approach.
Well, you see the success of the Valley and what all is going on there. So in the strategy sense, we talk about isomorphism, or this idea of mimicking, looking at other firms and in general, right? We like to look at people who are successful and try to emulate some of the things they do, right? That's why we care about what sneakers LeBron James might wear, or the clothing that one of these people might wear.
Like us.
Yes.
Like our clothing. Speaking of, I'm getting really hot with my heated hoodie on. So
he has to turn his light off.
I got to turn it off, sorry.
But that's sort of, I think, part of it, right? There's, if you look at what gets the money and the success, venture capital money and so on, they're probably misattributing some of it. But I also would say there's probably a spillover effect too. Okay, we're going to start a new business. We need to get people who are good at doing this. So we're going to hire the same consultants, or we're going to hire the same people who are involved in those organizations that did those startups. They're trying to do everything they can to emulate where the money's going. And as you say, there are these clusters geographically different areas like Boston, like Atlanta even. And what you see in that process is that these organizations are trying to emulate that mimetic isomorphism, as we would say, those institutions that have had a lot of success raising venture capital.
All right, fair enough. Let me just play devil's advocate, find my tinfoil hat here, put that on. What about the argument that this is a clever way to get young college graduates to work their tails off for not a lot of money? So you're coming to this real expensive part of the country, be it San Francisco or Boston or Atlanta even, and not always, contrary to some what I think is popular belief, not always paying huge salaries, at least for the entry-level positions, and expecting employees to basically live at the job and making it possible to do so. So you've got all the food and buffets and what have you, and you're basically taking college students and saying, don't go to the real world. This is like a halfway house for college graduates. You have parties and kegs and beer pong and Nerf battles and beanbag chairs. It's just a half step into reality. In exchange for that, you're just going to, you know, bust your ass all the time and never question anything your supervisor says and live, eat, and breathe this company. Always wear the attire, logos, because that's a recurring thing that you hear in a lot of these stories. From HubSpot to Theranos and everything in between, like, you do not question the, you know, we're here to change the world. Everyone here is a rock star. Like, all this culty stuff. Is that a way to get young people to work real hard for not a lot of money?
Yeah, and going off that too, I think that's what the Villarreal research talked about with regards to like lack of accountability. It's that the leaders don't get held to the same standard, right? They can make mistakes and everything. But yeah, no, I think there's certainly something to it. They're bringing people in with the promise of riches, and they're dangling that carrot out there, but saying, hey, until we can get there, because we are a startup, here's some equity in the company.
I think that's a big part of it. If we ever go public.
Right. You're going to be rich, because you see it all the time, right? You saw what happened with even Instagram when it got acquired by Facebook, even though it was not publicly traded. They got bought for $3 billion. So,
and they, I thought it was $1 billion.
Facebook paid $3.
That was one. All right. Busybodies, someone.
Fact check it.
Settle this for us. We don't have a follow through to Google it ourselves.
We'll figure it out later. But to help with that startup cost, hey, if we pay less and we give you equity, and if we're getting you excited about the potential of making money, think about all those IPOs and all this money that was being made by these people who took equity instead of a lot of money, then they were able to really use that as a tool or a mechanism to say, in the future, your hard work now is going to pay off. And it works in a lot of cases, right? People get stuff developed. They're able to create these entire platforms and they go public. Right. And of course, you hear about all the high profile ones, Uber, Facebook doing it, etc. And sure, it's great.
Fair enough.
But at what cost overall? I don't think we ever talk about those that haven't had success.
Yeah, I wonder what the percentage is of how many startups actually go public. Not many. How many get acquired?
Acquired, yeah.
Probably talking some real numbers at that point.
And you wonder too, how many of these people who've been involved in it keep going to these companies where they're getting these promises and they're not doing very well. And eventually they do hit it big too, because they've got skills. It's not like these people aren't skilled workers.
Do you hear those stories of, you know, it took five tries, but they finally took the right job and hit it big. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, again, they can use these stories to help with that process, but I do think they intentionally do that to create an environment to get things done. Think about it, right? They're usually able to take, as you say, people, not pay them well, but are very skilled, dangle that carrot out there of riches, but at the same time, they create this real strong culture. Because I think if at the end of the day, that's what might be one of the attributes people are making, attribution theory, maybe your side of the world, to dictate that's part of the reason why these companies are successful, because they have this overly focused, hyper-focused culture.
And Wired magazine, I just noticed I'm wearing a Wired hat. So maybe I'm on the take here, but they ran an article a year or two ago. I think it was called Why You Should Run Your Startup Like a Cult. You Should Run Your Startup Like a Cult, period. Here's How, I think was the title of it.
Right.
Making a lot of those same arguments that, you know, if you really want to do something big, you got to have everyone all in.
Yeah.
And I guess where I find this fascinating from my micro-psychological perspective is that in a lot of ways, these companies are doing everything that we say to from my field. They're like checking every single box. So naturally, you have to wonder, why are you doing everything we say to do? It's all about the psychological side of motivation. tapping into what your employees want and need at the stage of life that they're at. Like, they're doing everything right. You just wonder, cults also do everything right in that regard. So I guess maybe that's where this, the pessimism or whatever comes from, that, okay, you're doing some cult-like stuff. That doesn't necessarily mean you are a cult.
Well, and to your point too, there is some really bad stuff that they're doing, right? The gender aspects of things are really awful. And I mean, some of the stories we've heard out of some of these firms, once they start to crumble, those fringes around them crumble. Now, we've also seen other companies try to pull this off that aren't in tech, right? Mm-hmm. WeWork being a great example of this. WeWork was trying to do the same style for basically what is office leasing spaces, right?
Yeah. Approximately 2 hours ago, I was having a conversation on a similar topic with my class, and one of the students spoke up who had done an internship with WeWork. Now, they're reading the book by Dan Lyons about HubSpot. She said, yeah, that really reminds me of WeWork. So you're right.
Yeah. The whole thing that their founder tried to do was push WeWork as being an IT company, even though it's really was just a real estate rental company.
Hey, speaking of trying to be a real company, I...
That was a real estate company?
Huh? Anyway, I think that our self-imposed sponsorship hiatus, you know, the one we had from the...
The HR tracker thing. That went well.
Yeah, that debacle. Yeah, I think it's up.
No kidding. So, do we have another sponsor?
Of course we got sponsors. Business Paradox, man. You know everyone wants a piece of this.
Yeah, that's true. Cool, so what do we got?
Damned if I know.
Well, aren't you the one that... Whatever, it doesn't matter, so long as it's not HR Tracker again.
I'd remember that.
Okay, well, let's give it a go.
All right,
here we go.
Managing through a pandemic is tough. Doing it well? Not possible. And yet, somehow, you've done it. Through sheer grit, determination, otherworldly talents heretofore unseen among mortal humans, you've guided your department, task force, subcommittee, maybe even a whole company, through this challenging time. You deserve to pat yourself on the back, but this is no time to rest on your laurels. You've earned the respect of your employees, but have you earned their undying love and devotion? Would your direct reports walk into fire, literal fire, for you? If not, you need to contact Golden Calf Consulting. Golden Calf can help teach your subordinates what it truly means to be a subordinate, but it has to start with you. Look, no one's going to worship you until you start worshiping yourself. You need to understand that your management prowess is more than just luck. It's a result of hard work, determination, and divine grace. It's a sign that the Almighty or the aliens or something favors you above all other men or women, sorry. It's just that almost all our clients are men. And so anyway, Golden Calf can help you to develop the narcissistic delusions necessary for your people to see you as the demigod that you are. We'll teach you how to transform employee respect into adoration through the strategic deployment of frat house amenities that teach employees to enjoy being at work, so much so that they gradually forget they even have, or, sorry, had, a life outside of work. What's it matter? You're the only family they need. So let us teach you how to turn free beer into devotion and free Kool-Aid into, well, one step at a time, shall we? In the meantime, look your employees in the eyes. If you see anything less than an unthinking willingness, no, a desire, a need, to sell their earthly possessions, hole up in an underground bunker, and fight to the death for your God-given right to dodge income taxes, then you need to call us, Golden Calf Consulting. We put the cult in workplace culture.
What? Paul, what was that?
I don't know. I think that slipped through our Keanu Reeves filter.
But wait. Justin! What was that? Oh, man. We might have to fire Justin. That's ridiculous.
We might have to. This is his job. I mean, I know I guess I read that, but I don't think about what I say on the show. I mean, come on. Everyone knows that.
I mean, that's the whole thing, right? We don't think about what that's we say. We just say it.
We have no filter. That's why we hired the guy. That's why we have a Keanu Reeves filter.
Justin! Man! Ugh. Sorry, busybodies. Anyway, I think we were talking about WeWork and them trying to give that appearance that they had this IT culture thing going on, whereas they're really not, and trying to package something old as something new.
That reminds me, if you haven't heard it yet,
there's a really amazing podcast about everything that went on at WeWork. It's season one of a show called Foundering. It's based on and also narrated by Ellen Hewitt, who did a lot of the early reporting on them for Bloomberg. And I'll tell you what, if you want to hear a blow-by-blow account of everything we're talking about here, the indoctrination tactics, the use of youthful largesse, like beer and parties, and the prospect of getting rich from an eventual IPO, to gloss over the low salaries and long hours, the hero worship of the company's leadership, punishments for those who ask questions, man, apparently it was all there at WeWork. And, you know, to go back to what I was saying a few minutes ago, there's a bit of an irony, a paradox here, where a lot of these borderline culty sort of startups are really doing everything that someone who teaches a class like mine would say to do. From a psychology of management perspective, they're really doing everything right. And so I think it's like a lot of things that there's some power in this stuff. There's power in psychology, and you can use it in good ways. You can use it in bad ways, and you can have good intentions, but go a little too far. So I think the challenge for a lot of these startups in particular is finding where the line is. You're a startup. You need to grow fast or you're not going to survive. You need to have a lot of passion and drive from your employees in order to grow fast. I don't think it's a bad thing to foster this type of all-in culture. The question is, how do we know when we've gone too far, when we've gone from startup to cult? Like, where's that line?
It's almost like that idea of too much of a good thing is actually bad. And if you're doing everything that we say to do, but kind of to an extreme, right? If you look at what they're doing, it's sort of taking what we talk about in classes or when we do executive education, the things that you should be doing, they just take them and they give them that one extra little tweak that goes sort of above and beyond, I think, what we tend to recommend even.
That's true. I think it's possible, well, we've seen that it's possible, to lose touch with how far you've gone in a given direction. You're doing these tweaks. You're taking things a step further than might be advisable in terms of getting commitment and motivation and drive out of your employees. And you don't realize when you've gone to crazy town.
Yeah, you've crossed some sort of boundary.
Yeah, like, you know, like the Stanford prison experiments back in the 70s. And
yes. Oh, that's a great example, right? Right. It's where they actually bought into what they were doing, even though...
Including the people running the experiment. And he, what's his name? Zimbardo, Dr. Zimbardo. He frequently is the first to admit that, yeah, I went way too far. Like, should have pulled the plug on that thing way beforehand, way before I actually did. It took someone coming in from the outside and seeing what was going on and saying, what in the world are you people doing here? And I think that's not a bad, what's the word I'm looking for? Not like a standard, but it's a good test for your own culture. If someone from the outside world comes in and says, you people are nuts,
yeah,
it's at least probably a good sign that you need to take stock of where you're at.
Like a litmus test.
Right? A litmus one test. Those, thank you. Yes, that's what I'm looking for.
That's, yeah, exactly. That's actually a really great point. If you're in a startup environment, especially these high-tech ones that are notoriously known for bad culture to the point that it usually generates negative public relations, that might be something that even the venture capitalists who are looking to invest in these companies might want to look for, is having some sort of cultural gauge, right? Are we seeing that they've gone off the deep end? Now, of course, there might be ways that they obfuscate what they're actually doing when they have external people come in, right? And that's what cults do in a lot of ways too. When they know that there's a threat, they can behave.
Which is another litmus test. When you find you have to change your behavior when someone from outside your company comes in, what's that tell you?
But, you know, once you're inside, sometimes you don't realize that's not normal.
Right.
Because you're having some level of success. You're being praised for that work. You're getting that feeling of being part of something important.
Which is where I think the outside perspective comes in handy. You've got someone who's not acculturated, indoctrinated into it.
I think the problem with that, though, is that the outsider might not realize what's going on because they can only be there for so long.
Right.
I don't know. It's tough. It's certainly a fascinating sort of concept. And I do think there's a lot that needs to still be explored in this area as to how much is acceptable. I mean, we do want these companies to be successful, but at what cost?
You know, do a quick internet search on this stuff. And I myself was surprised at how big of an issue this is. Just this morning, I looked up or I stumbled onto an article from HR Technologist by Pooja Lalwani. Sorry if I mangled that. And she just lists one after another of these like seemingly well-meaning companies that went too far. She mentions WeWork. She mentions
Away Luggage Company, I wasn't familiar with, says their culture involved public shaming on Slack.
Wow.
16-hour workdays, no time off, employee surveillance, bullying and firing. Think's period underwear, founded and initially run by a woman. Yeah, she was kind of forced to step down after all these allegations of sexual harassment. Reported nudity, I'm not sure what was involved with that, by its female founder and CEO. Now, going back to your point about the gender misogyny and stuff, you know, this is the last thing these startups need.
Well, and that's exactly it, too. And what's really interesting that in that case of that underwear company, it was a female version trying to, I would probably say, emulate some of the things that these male-dominated companies were doing.
Good point.
Because that's where the money goes.
Yep.
And trying to set yourself apart. One of the things that businesses are always trying to find is their niche in some way. Because you've got this landscape full of all these different competitors. You've got all these different elements of noise out there. And you want to cut through that noise and set yourself apart in some way. And that could have been working for them. And it just reinforces that behavior. I mean, I don't know. I would have to look further into those cases, but I would assume that's part of it. That copying by others, right? Yeah.
What did you call that? Mimetic isomorphism?
Mimetic. Yep. Yep, exactly. Mimetic isomorphism. Yep. It's a fancy term for just copying what's working.
Copying what's working. Yes. It's hard to provide real concrete advice on this. Basically, if you think your startup is becoming a cult, it's probably becoming a cult. And if you can't get an outside perspective on that to confirm or deny it, it's, I don't know, helpful to look in the mirror and say, is this the way I plan to run a company? I don't know.
There's something that might also work in these kinds of contexts as well, trying to figure out what your core values are. And I know there's different exercises that can be done. I know there's consulting firms out there that do these things. I know one assignment that's done to help understand the core essence of a company is to pretend you take a little team and you send them to Mars, quote unquote Mars, and then they have to establish that business from the ground up. And their goal is to figure out those elements that are necessary to make that company successful in a new environment, basically.
That's a really cool idea.
Yeah, there's little activities like that. One of the things that I try to get people to do is ask the question why, and ask it like 5 times in a row. So it's like, why is this going on? Ask it again. It's okay. So you answer it, but then why? And it's like when a kid asks you questions, right? But the whole idea is that it helps you boil it down to an essence, right? What's that easy phrase that's something everybody can understand? And that's the key.
And that's particularly relevant here because a almost defining characteristic of any cult-like organization is you never question
what's
happening, especially if it's decisions coming from up above. So having that just built into your culture that we have these activities, we have them specifically to ask why. It's a good way of keeping yourself honest, I think.
Yeah, I think that's probably a really good thing to do.
Worked out well. It kind of similarly, I don't know how, if this is actually what happened, but you kind of get the sense, going back to that HubSpot example and Dan Lyon's Disrupted book, it sort of seems like, I don't know if you're familiar with the aftermath of that, they allegedly did some pretty shady stuff to try to prevent the book's publication.
Really?
But once the book was published, there was some fallout, and then it seems like they said, all right, this has happened. There's like a best-selling book about us being a cult-like workplace. Maybe there's something learning to be done here. Maybe we can make lemons out of the lemonade. And you get the sense that maybe that happened. Like they kind of used it as a wake-up call to, you know, rein in the stuff that was a little bit out of hand. But they also stood up for some of the things that they said, you know, he didn't like this, but we think it is good. And here's why. So it forced them to maybe critically sort of examine themselves, look in the mirror a bit. And they're doing pretty well, apparently, these days. So maybe that was ultimately beneficial to them.
That's a great point. And you wonder how much of that was that influence of that book in making them have to look in that mirror, reflect on what they've done, and how does that impact perceptions? That's one of the things. Perceptions matter.
Oh, yeah.
And if the perception you're setting is wrong, then you've got to figure out either we've got to make an adjustment or the audience we might be catering to changes in a way that we don't even like.
Right. That's a good point.
Now, that's really an interesting question. I do think we should have an episode at some point about that idea of reflecting, because I think it's such an invaluable part of things that people don't spend enough time doing, especially in these examples here with a cult. We just mentioned this idea of reinforcing behaviors. Oh, we're doing this. We got rewarded in some way. There was some success, whether it's we hit a milestone faster than we anticipated, or investors gave us money that we didn't anticipate, or something. There was something that triggered that sort of that gambling sense when you hit a jackpot on a slot machine, even though it's a penny slot and you won 5 cents, that triggered that same response.
Trigger some dopamine and and you do it again. Yeah.
Right, exactly. That might be why reflecting is so important in these scenarios, because you can step back and go, okay, we've been doing this for a minute.
Why?
And just ask why. And is it the right thing to do? Because you got to think, some of the stuff that they're doing, they have to think, there's something wrong with this. Like the nudity aspect, right? We've heard the stuff with Enron, for example, and their shenanigans. In this example with this underwear company you mentioned, you think about that nudity. I mean, when does that make sense?
I mean, they are selling underwear, but I don't know enough about the context.
If it's come out where they're talking about nudity explicitly,
yeah,
that means there's something wrong. And of course, the sexual assault end of it's really bad, but
it sounds like it was not being used in the service of marketing. It was being used in the service of getting employees in line from what little bit I've read about it.
Right. It was misused.
Yeah.
And I know that there are still some imbalances there on what's appropriate between men and women. I understand it's much harder to figure out what's appropriate attire in some cases. Men have it easy. I will not lie.
Yeah.
Button down, some slacks, pretty straightforward order.
I believe you mean the
battery-powered
hoodie.
The powered hoodie, a baseball cap, and I'm in jeans. So jeans, that's going to be it.
I'm not wearing.
Oh.
This is Zoom. I mean, yeah.
Paul's naked, I guess, under that. Fortunately, I can only see, you know, from the chest from up. The so
hoodie up, I'm all good. I'm all business.
Party down below, business up. No, wait. Party down below, cult on top.
Cult on top, party below.
Oh, crap. Yeah, and as we go off the rails, folks.
Yeah. Where's our producer? Justin!
Justin!
Why are you letting us say this stuff?
You're supposed to control this stuff, man. Oh, what a
loser.
Useless. Betty's drunk.
Betty's drunk again.
Yep. Keanu, if you're available, we need your help.
We have something to deal with. We need your help, Keanu.
But truly, though, I think in a corporate environment, there's laws against this stuff. That should force you to look at yourself and go, what was I thinking? I'm going to channel my inner Dr. Phil. I mean, that will kill your company faster than you can even imagine, especially as a startup. You don't have all these resources to play these kinds of games.
Yeah, your reputation is about one of the only cards you have when you're a startup.
That's just about it, right? And venture capitalists, a lot of them, the idea is important, but they're looking to invest in the person who's running that show too. If they're hearing this kind of stuff,
they don't want a headache. Yeah.
That they're not going to want that. They don't want that to transfer on them either. They don't want that spillover effect.
You have to wonder, like, the mindset of someone that goes into hazing as a management tactic, like, what in their life led them to think that was an appropriate response? And I guess if you have a very frat-like culture, maybe hazing is on your subconscious agenda, but... Mm.
Now, with all that said, culture is so important to any organization, especially a startup. The critical elements that we're saying here is that there's a lot of things that you could look at that these cults have done in this Villarreal article that Paul pulled from here. There's certainly some elements in there that you would want to look at in terms of how can we do this in a legal way that's going to be fair to everyone, regardless of gender, sex, political beliefs, whatever, the whole spectrum.
And that's effective. Managing through fear is not effective in the long run. No. Get something done right now, maybe, but you're going to pay for it with interest.
Yeah, I certainly do believe in that notion of if you take care of your employees, they will work harder for you.
You want them to want to do what you want them to do. Like if they legitimately want to do what you want them to do, your job's easier as a manager and everyone's happier.
And the things that drive that would be things like they agree in the mission of the company, or they agree with the vision that you have, or that story that you're saying, hey, this is what I think we can do if we're able to accomplish the delivery of this product or service we're creating. Look at what's going to happen if we can do this and drive people's passion to do that. You don't have to create the cult-like environment. You just need to create an environment that's healthy for them to then take those values and go with it. I mean, sure, have a foosball table and some air hockey and stuff like that. That's great. You should have that, especially in creative environments. You want to give people outlets to give their brain a chance to decompress. Let them go have sleep sometimes. I mean,
the culture has to fit the job. Yeah.
Right. You know, sleep sometimes is the biggest thing to get their minds back in. Or let them take vacation. I get that there's deadlines and you don't want people to trump you and stuff like that. But the reality is that your people are going to be so much more effective if they can get some decompression time in there.
Now, someone's going to call us out because we're always singing the praises of Steve Jobs. And he was, as far as I know, not guilty of any kind of perpetuating a cult-like culture, but he was, by his own admission, a very difficult person to work for and with, and he got incredible results out of it. So there are edge cases. The thing I think a lot of people don't get is that, you know, Steve Jobs was hard on his employees, so I'm going to do that too. Well, you're not Steve Jobs. No one else is. As always, your management style has to fit your own personality and who you are as a person. If you're going to push the limits, you bloody hell better have the skill and the reasoning behind it to do so.
Paul just went English there for a second with the bloody hell, but, you know, we'll let that one slide. No,
English to American filter.
You know, the Steve Jobs example is always very relevant, because if you ask a lot of those Apple employees about their tenure working for Steve Jobs, many of them say that it was the time in their lives that they were the most proud of. Yep. They also said it was probably some of the hardest times of their life. Yep. I think the difference is that Steve Jobs focused in on treating people equally. It was very clear that he didn't care if you were, you know, man, woman, child, whatever. He had that same temperament no matter what. He treated people the same.
I think it did have something to do with, well, I say I think, I'm just...
His LSD use?
I'm recalling, not that one. I'm recalling a different interview where he talked about he was particularly hard on people who he felt did not perform up to their actual abilities.
Right.
He said, if I go out and look for A-plus players, and if they give me A-minus work, I'm going to bludgeon them more than an A-minus player giving me A-minus work. Like, if I hired you because you're the best of the best, why aren't you being what you can be? Why aren't you performing at that level?
Right.
I think that's where a lot of what you're saying came from, that people said he was hard to work with, but they're so proud of what they accomplished during that time in their career because he held them to the level that they were in fact capable of performing at.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think that's why they are proud of the work they did during that era. Not a cult. Might have been a hard place to work at, but not a cult.
I think I'm this way too. I don't mind being bashed about the head and ears if I am phoning it in.
Right.
And someone calls me on it. I appreciate that. Like, thank you for the wake-up call.
Right.
Maybe.
But as you and I know, there's some personal attributes that might cause you to misperceive a situation too.
There is that.
You know, going back to our study we've done in the past, and we'll do something else on that. I don't want to, you know, this is already going long as it is, but.
I like that idea.
Yeah. So
stay tuned.
Anyway, I think it has gotten long at this point too. So we might want to, any parting thoughts there, Paul?
Did you almost call me Phil?
I almost did call you Phil. I'm sorry. That's what happens when you're working with Phil and you just send an email to Phil early. So hold on, let me read.
Dr. Phil imitation.
Any parting thoughts there, Paul?
There we go. I think it's all been said. Well, okay, I do have a parting thought. One of the recurring findings regarding this topic is that there's a lot of involvement of young people, impressionable young people. And that's not just people being recruited into these companies, but also the people running these companies. So it's especially a topic for our, you know, younger listeners to be mindful of when you're perhaps running your own startup or being recruited by a startup or working at a startup where this cult-like mentality does exist. It tends to be targeted on your age group.
And that was the rest of the story, folks.
That was the rest of the story.
Thanks for listening. Until next time.
Good day.
Good day.
The Busyness Paradox is distributed by Paul Harvey and Frank Butler. Our theme music is adapted from It's Business Time by Jermaine Clements and Brett McKenzie. Our production manager is Justin One Take. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and we'd love to hear from you. Please send questions, comments, or ideas for future episode topics to input@businessparadox.com or find us on Twitter. Also, be sure to visit our website, businessparadox.com, to read our blog posts and for links to the articles and other resources mentioned in today's show. Finally, please take a moment to rate and follow or subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, or your preferred podcast provider. It's business.